their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
All right, that was War Pigs, Black Sabbath. Welcome to Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett, and today we have a very special show for you. We are going to have the headlines presented to us by the people who do that and National Corporate Radio. And then we are going to hear a talk by Noam Chomsky called Media Control, The Spectacular Achievements of Propaganda. Directly to the news with National Corporate Radio. Here we go.
This is NCR, National Corporate Radio News. Our news for you.
President Bush decides maybe democracy isn't such a good idea after all.
Steve Jobs renegotiates his deal with the devil to include a shiny fiddle made of gold.
And apes threaten to use the pointed stick option in their continuing dispute over the banana tree.
Those stories and more coming up on All Things Condescended.
First, this news.
From NCR News in Washington, I'm Jackie Lyer. At a press conference this morning, White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan downplayed the significance of photos that show disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff and President Bush together. In the photos, the president can be seen taking a large stack of money from Abramoff, softly caressing Mr. Abramoff's buttocks as he kneels to kiss them, and assisting Mr. Abramoff in his effort to set a bomb on fire. Mr. McClellan says the president denies knowing the man in the biblical sense because his pastor told him that oral sex doesn't count. When asked for a reaction to McClellan's statement, Mr. Abramoff said he's not one to kiss and tell, at least not until a fresh plea agreement is on the table. The trial of Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling of Enron began in Houston today. The former CEO and COO of the scandal-ridden company are accused of defrauding investors, employees, and the public in a very big-ass sort of way. No word has come yet on Mr. Skilling's legal strategy, but attorneys from Lay's team indicate that he plans to plead not guilty by reason of stupidity. It now appears that the Democratic attempt to mount a filibuster against Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito is itself a bust. Get it? Because filibuster has the word bust in it. In a related development, a team of scientists at Oxford released a report this week about the way people consume their news. The study indicates that people tend to take news stories more seriously if the headline includes a wacky pun or rhyme, such as Osama and Yo Mama. International supermodel and convicted drug fiend Kate Moss says she plans to pen an autobiography soon. As part of her plea agreement, Moss plans to use proceeds from the book to help inner-city youth buy more cocaine on the condition that they not hide it, but divide it. This is NCR News. In NCR's business update, media giant Disney has acquired the popular CGI filmmaking studio, Pixar. The two companies will now join forces to become Disnar, or possibly Pixney, depending on which sounds dumber. On Wall Street, at this hour, the Dow is dancing on the ceiling at 11,238, while the Nasdaq is going to have a party all night long at 2442. The S&P still hates Lionel Richie.
In an effort to increase our appeal to wholesome evangelical Christians throughout the country, NCR is proud to present a new ongoing series, Holy Hunches, Pat Robertson's views on the end times and God's great America, which is in decline due to all the godless sinners who surround us. For the first installment in this series, we turn to NCR's religiosist, Ivan Flotsam. Ivan?
Thanks, Anne, and may God not kill you a lot. Pat Robertson is host of the Christian Broadcasting Network 700 Club television program. During his broadcast, he often gives his inspired views on politics, morality, religion, and the world. He has made numerous predictions based on his direct conversations with God. For example, just recently, Pat Robertson had this to say about Ariel Sharon's severe stroke.
I consider Ariel Sharon to be a friend of mine, but I have to be honest with you. The Lord is very clear about his land. Mr. Sharon had started to divide Israel, so the Lord reasserted his authority by giving the Prime Minister a severe stroke. You see, friends, despite my repeated urgings, Mr. Sharon has failed to embrace the sweet Lord Jesus Christ as his Savior. Now, God willing, there's still time for Sharon to regain consciousness, repent, and accept the Christ into his wicked Jew heart. But I must warn you, the end is near.
According to Mr. Robertson, the Lord is not pleased with the environmental movement. He said that God granted humans, and Americans in particular, the resources of his bountiful earth to help them prosper and multiply. Rejecting such gifts is tantamount to blasphemy.
Coal, petroleum, and natural gas are gifts from the Almighty. If we continue to let the environmental terrorists block our access to the fuel sources promised by the Bible, then we may as well be asking Jesus to smite us all. When the gays and the feminists force us to recycle, we have unwittingly invited the devil into our homes.
When asked how he would guide the non-Christians of the world to the proper path, he revealed his latest project, a Christ-centered theme park in Israel.
It will be called the Galilee World Heritage Park and International Baptismal Outreach Ministry Center. We're looking into a site on the Sea of Galilee in Israel. Time is running out, and we must prepare the flock for the return of Jesus. All Israelis will be invited to convert to righteous Christianity and receive 50% off their admission to Galilee World Heritage Park with a free ride on the Jesus Christ Holy Roller Coaster. I am simply a vessel for God's will.
This has been NCR's first installment of Holy Hunches, Pat Robertson's views on the end times and God's great America, which is in decline due to all the godless sinners who surround us. Stay tuned to NCR for more information and inspiration from God's favorite television and radio preacher. For NCR News, I'm Ivan Flotsam.
Deepak Ramchandani Johnson, known to his friends as Jeff, was a normal American man. A good job as a software engineer, a beautiful wife, two lovely kids with ADD, and a big SUV to compensate for Mr. Johnson's little Johnson, Mr. Johnson was living the American dream. He was, that is, until one day Khalid's dream was shattered by a team of peace agents from the Department of Homeland Security, who picked him up and took him on a free vacation to Saudi Arabia. While visiting this exotic land, Mr. Johnson unfortunately got a bad case of extraordinary rendition, which resulted in him being tortured nearly to death. It later turned out that the Department of Homeland Security had meant to pick up some other Arabic guy instead, a guy who resembled Deepak in no way at all, except for the being Arabic part. An honest mistake, but apparently now, having survived this ordeal, Mr. Johnson is a little upset, and he's preparing to sue the federal government. Mr. Johnson joins us now in studio. Deepak, it's an honor to have you here today.
Thank you, but I am Indian.
Now, I should start out by noting that, you're under arrest.
What? Why? No, not again!
All right. I was just kidding. Did you see him jump, Anne?
Yeah, like a foot.
Oh, that was rich. Anyways, so you're claiming all of this was a mistake.
I'm not claiming that, Noah. It was a terrible mistake. And this kind of thing cannot merely be abided. There must be redress for what happened to me.
Fighting words. You also claim you were tortured by the Saudi government.
That's right, yes, I was.
Now, it's easy to say you didn't deserve this, but what if really you did? How does that make you feel?
Well, I have to say that
I... Do you mind if I turn this light a little bit to put it right in your face?
You know, I don't think...
Where are you hiding the bomb, Deepak? Did you think somehow you were going to get away with it? Where's the bomb, you dirty jihadist?
You're crazy. Oh, sweet Vishnu, save me.
That's enough, Noah. Why don't you go take a powder?
Take a powder? Anne, nobody says that anymore.
Noah, please.
Fine.
Sorry about that. Noah can get a little carried away sometimes when he's interviewing our subjects.
Sure.
It's okay. You can talk to me. Do you want some water? A cigarette?
No.
Look, everything's gonna be fine. Now then, take us back to that day when you were picked up by Homeland Security. What were you doing wrong that day?
My wife was sick that day, so I was getting the kids ready for school. I was running late for work myself.
Right. And is that when the agents arrived at the door?
Right about then, yes.
So, what did you do with the bomb? Send one of the kids off to school with it?
What bomb?
The one you were building, when Homeland Security showed up.
Do you people listen to your own news? I am Indian, I tell you. I am a software engineer. I work for Microsoft, for Christ's sake. I don't know how to make a bomb. I don't know how many ways I can tell you they got the wrong guy.
Are you going to show me the secret plans for the bomb before all those kids die, or am I going to have to shake it out of you? Do you want to see the NCR water board set, huh? Because it's right back here.
What the hell? Rush Limbaugh said you were liberals. Up yours, NCR.
Did you find out where the bomb is?
Nah. Another Islamo-fascist got away.
Oh, well. That's all things condescended. I'm no angel.
And I'm Ambazo. Thanks for joining us.
Support for NCR comes from your mom. You know what I mean? She did last night. Contributors also include Corn-tato. Corn-tato combines the goodness of corn with the convenience of potato. For more NCR and to learn more about Corn-tato, visit us on the web immediately at www.corntato.com. This is NCR, National Corporate Radio News. Our news for you.
All right, we're back. This is Indie Media On Air, and that was National Corporate Radio. For more information on the people who do that, visit corntato.com. Our next talk that we're going to be presenting is a Noam Chomsky talk, Media Control, the Spectacular Achievements of Propaganda. It was recorded on March 17th of 1991 in Kent Field, California. And it's a great talk, and just to give you a sense of it, part of what Chomsky is talking about is the role of media and democracy, which we often talk about on Indie Media. Chomsky says, the issue is whether we want to live in a free society or whether we want to live under what amounts to a form of self-imposed totalitarianism, with a bewildered herd, marginalized, directed elsewhere, terrified, screaming patriotic slogans, fearing for their lives, and admiring with awe the leader who saved them from destruction, while the educated masses goose-step on command and repeat the slogans they're supposed to repeat, and the society deteriorates at home. We end up serving as a mercenary enforcer state, hoping that others are going to pay us to smash up the world. So without any more delay, let's hear this talk, Media Control, Spectacular Achievements of Propaganda, and you can go to Seven Stories Press on the web to find more information about the printed version of this. You're listening to Indie Media On Air, KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the web at kpfk.org.
The topic that was announced, disinformation and the Gulf War, is actually a bit narrower than what I would like to talk about. I will get to that in a moment, but I'd like to suggest a somewhat broader context for looking at that particular issue. The context actually has to do with what kind of a world and what kind of a society we want to live in, and in particular, in what sense of democracy do we want this to be a democratic society? In opening that question for a little bit of discussion, let me begin by counterposing two different conceptions of democracy. One conception of democracy has it that a democratic society is one in which the public has the means to participate in some meaningful way in management of their own affairs, and the means of information are in fact open and free. If you look up democracy in the dictionary, you'll get a definition, something like that. An alternative conception of democracy is that the public must be barred from management of their own affairs, and the means of information must be kept narrowly and rigidly controlled. Now, that may sound like an odd conception of democracy, but it's important to understand that it is the prevailing conception, and in fact it long has been, not just in operation, but even in theory. There's a long history that goes back to the earliest modern democratic revolutions in 17th century England, which largely expresses this point of view. I'm just going to keep to the modern period and say a few words about how that notion of democracy develops and why, and how the problem of media and disinformation enters within that context. Let's begin with the first modern government propaganda operation. That was under the Woodrow Wilson administration. Woodrow Wilson was elected president in 1916 on the platform Peace Without Victory. That was right in the middle of the First World War. The population was extremely pacifistic, saw no reason to become involved in a European war. The Wilson administration was committed to war and had to do something about it. They established a government propaganda commission called the Creel Commission, which succeeded within 6 months in turning a pacifistic population into a hysterical, warmongering population, which wanted to destroy everything German, tear the Germans limb from limb, go to war, and save the world. That was a major achievement, and it led to a further achievement. Right at that time and after the war, the same techniques were used to whip up a hysterical Red Scare, it was called, which succeeded in pretty much destroying unions, eliminating such dangerous problems as freedom of the press and freedom of political thought. There was very strong support from the media, from the business establishment, which in fact pushed much of this work, and it was in general a great success. Among those who participated and participated actively and enthusiastically were the progressive intellectuals, people of the John Dewey Circle, who took great pride in, as you can see from their own writings at the time, as they take pride in having shown that what they called the more intelligent members of the community, namely them, were able to drive a reluctant population into a war which that population didn't want by terrifying them and eliciting jingoist fanaticism and so on. The means that were used were extensive. For example, there was a good deal of fabrication of atrocities by the Huns, Belgian babies with their arms torn off, all sorts of awful things that you still read in history books. They were all invented by the British propaganda ministries, whose own commitment at the time, as they put it in their secret deliberations, was to control the thought of all the world. But crucially, they wanted to control the thought of the more intelligent members of the community in the United States, who would then disseminate the propaganda that they were concocting and convert the pacifistic country to wartime hysteria. And that worked very well. And it taught a lesson. The lesson that it taught was that state propaganda, when supported by the educated classes and when no deviation is permitted from it, can have a big effect. It was a lesson learned by Hitler. It's learned by many others, and it has been pursued to this day. One of the groups that learned the lesson, naturally, was the business community. There had already been a public relations industry in the United States. The United States pioneered in the public relations industry. Its commitment was to control the public mind, as its leaders put it. They learned a lot from the successes of the Creel Commission and the successes in creating the Red Scare and its aftermath. And in fact, the public relations industry underwent a huge expansion at that time. It did succeed for some time in creating almost total subordination of the public to the to business rule through the 1920s. This was extreme, so extreme that congressional committees, the La Follette Committee, began to investigate it as we moved into the 1930s, which is where a lot of our information about it comes from. Now, another group that was impressed by these successes was liberal democratic theorists and leading media figures, like, for example, Walter Lippmann, who was the dean of American journalists, major foreign policy and domestic critic, and also a major theorist of liberal democracy. If you take a look at his collected essays, you'll see that they're subtitled something like a theory of progressive theory of liberal democratic thought or something like that. Lippmann was involved in these propaganda commissions and recognized their achievements. He argued that what was happening was that there was what he called a revolution in the art of democracy. Namely, it was now possible to manufacture consent, that is, to bring about agreement on the part of the public to things that they didn't want by the new techniques of propaganda. And he thought also that this was a good idea, in fact, necessary. It was necessary because, as he put it, the common interests elude public opinion entirely, and they can only be understood and managed by a specialized class of responsible men who are smart enough to figure things out. So a small, relatively small elite, the most intelligent men of the community that the Deweyites were talking about, they can understand the common interests, what all of us care about, but these things elude the general public. This is a view that goes way back, hundreds of years. It's also a typical Leninist view. In fact, it has very close resemblance to the Leninist conception that a vanguard of revolutionary intellectuals should take state power using popular revolutions as the force that brings them to state power, and then drive the stupid masses towards a future that they're too dumb and incompetent to envision for themselves. The liberal democratic theory and Marxism-Leninism are very close in their common ideological assumptions. I think that's one reason why people have found it so easy over the years to shift from one position to another without any particular sense of change. It's just a matter of assessing where power is. You know, maybe there'll be a popular revolution and that'll put us into state power, or maybe there won't be, in which case we'll just work for the people with real power, the business community, but we'll do the same thing. We'll drive the stupid masses towards a world that they're too dumb to understand for themselves. Well, Lippmann backed this up by a pretty elaborated theory of progressive democracy. He argued that in a democracy, there are two class, in a properly functioning democracy, there's two classes of citizens. There is, first of all, the class of citizens who have to take some active role in running the affairs of the general affairs. That's the specialized class. They're the people who analyze, who execute, make decisions, sort of run things in the political system, in the economic system, and in the ideological system. That's a small percentage of the population. Anyone who puts these ideas forth is always part of that small group, naturally. And they're talking about, you know, what we do about those others. The others who are out of this small group, the big majority of the population, they are what Lippmann called a bewildered herd. And we have to protect ourselves from the trampling and the rage of the bewildered herd. Now, there are two functions now in a democracy. Then the specialized class, the responsible men, they carry out the executive function, which means they do the thinking and the planning and, you know, understand the common interests. And then the bewildered herd, they have a function in a democracy too. Their function in a democracy, he said, is to be spectators, not participants in action. But they have more of a function than that because it's a democracy. They are allowed to lend their weight occasionally to one or another member of the specialized class. In other words, they're allowed to say, we want you to be our leader, or we want you to be our leader. That's because it's a democracy, not a totalitarian state. That's called an election. But once they've lent their weight to one or another member of the specialized class, they're supposed to sink back and become spectators of action, but not participants. That's in a properly functioning democracy, and there's a logic behind it. There's even a kind of compelling moral principle behind it. The compelling moral principle is that the mass of the public is just too stupid to be able to understand things. If they try to participate in managing their own affairs, they're just going to cause trouble, and therefore it would be immoral and improper to permit them to do this. We have to tame the bewildered herd, not allow the bewildered herd to rage and trample and destroy things. It's pretty much the same logic that says that it would be improper to let a three-year-old run across the street. You don't give a three-year-old that kind of freedom because the three-year-old doesn't know how to handle that freedom. And correspondingly, you don't allow the bewildered herd to become participants in action. They'll just cause trouble. So we need something to tame the bewildered herd, and that something is this new revolution in the art of democracy, the manufacture of consent. The media, the schools, the popular culture has to divide for the political class, the decision makers. It has to give them some tolerable sense of reality, although it also has to instill the proper beliefs, because remember, there is an unstated premise here. the unstated premise, and even the responsible men have to disguise this from themselves, the unstated premise has to do with the question of how they get into the position where they have the authority to make decisions. And the way they do that, of course, is by serving people with real power. And the people with real power are the ones who own the society, which is a pretty narrow group. And if the specialized class can come along and say, I can serve your interests, then they'll be part of the executive group. You've got to keep that quiet. And that means they have to have instilled in them the beliefs and the doctrines that will serve the interests of private power. Unless they can master that skill, they're not part of the specialized class. So we have one kind of educational system directed to the responsible men, the specialized class. They have to be deeply indoctrinated in the values and the interests of private power, and the state corporate nexus that's closely linked that represents it. And if they can get through that, they can be part of the specialized class. For the rest, the bewildered herd, they just have to be basically distracted. Turn their attention to something else, keep them out of trouble, make sure that they remain at most spectators of action, occasionally lending their weight to one or another of the real leaders who they may select among. That point of view has been developed by lots and lots of other people. In fact, it's pretty conventional. So, for example, the leading contemporary modern theologian and also foreign policy critic, Reinhold Niebuhr, sometimes called the theologian of the establishment, the guru of George Kennan and the Kennedy intellectuals and others, the way he put it was that rationality is a very narrowly restricted skill. Only a small number of people have it. Most people are guided by just emotion and impulse. And those of us, of course, us who have rationality, we have to create necessary illusions and emotionally potent oversimplifications to keep the naive simpletons more or less on course. This became a substantial part of contemporary political science. The founder of the modern field of communications, one of the leading American political scientists, Harold Laswell, he explained a couple of years after this that this is all in the 1920s, the early 1930s, that we should not succumb to what he called democratic dogmatisms about men being the best judges of their own interests, because they're not. They're not the best judges of their own interests. We're the best judges of their interests. And we have to, therefore, just out of ordinary morality, make sure that they don't have an opportunity to opt to act on the basis of their misjudgments. In a totalitarian, what is nowadays called a totalitarian state, it's easy. You just hold a bludgeon over their heads, and if they get out of line, you smash them over the head. But as societies become more free and democratic, you lose that capacity, and therefore you have to turn to the techniques of propaganda. The logic is clear. Propaganda is to a democracy what the bludgeon is to a totalitarian state. And that's wise and good because, again, the common interests elude the bewildered herd. They can't figure them out. The public relations industry not only took this ideology on very explicitly, but also acted on it. That's a huge industry. Spending hundreds of, by now, probably something on the order of $1 billion a year or something. And its commitment all along was to controlling the public mind. Now,
you are listening to Indie Media On Air, and this is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara and on the net at kpfk.org. And I'm Chris Burnett. We are listening to a talk by Noam Chomsky called Media Control. I think it's one of the best talks I've actually heard on the subject by Chomsky. The subtitle is The Spectacular Achievements of Propaganda, and it's an older talk. It was recorded March 17th, 1991 in Kentfield, California. And there is a text version of this available from Seven Stories Press, and I bet you could do a search on Google or something and find the actual audio, or go to radioforall.net. It might even be posted there. But it's a great talk, and we're going to go right back into it. The Spectacular Achievements of Propaganda, Noam Chomsky.
In the 1930s, big problems arose again, as they had during the First World War. There was a huge depression. There was substantial labor organizing. In fact, in 1935, labor won its first major legislative victory, namely the right to organize with the Wagner Act. And that raised two serious problems. For one thing, democracy was misfunctioning. The bewildered herd was actually winning legislative victories, and it's not supposed to work that way. The other problem was that it was becoming possible for people to organize. And people have to be atomized and separated and alone. They're not supposed to organize because then they might be able to actually exert some, they might be something beyond spectators of action. They might actually be participants if many people with limited resources could get together to enter the political arena. That's really threatening. And a major response was taken on the part of business to ensure that this would be the last legislative victory for labor and that it would be the beginning of the end of this democratic deviation of popular organization. And in fact, it worked. That was the last legislative victory for labor. And from that point on, although the number of people in the unions, in fact, increased for a while during the Second World War, it then started dropping, the capacity to act through the unions began a steady drop. And it wasn't by accident. We're now talking about the business community, which spends lots and lots of money and attention and thought into how to deal with these problems through the public relations industry and other organizations like the National Association of Manufacturers and the Business Roundtable these days and so on. They set to work immediately to try to find a way to counter these democratic deviations. The first major trial was a year later in 1936. There was a major strike, the Bethlehem Steel Strike, out in western Pennsylvania, at Johnstown, the Mohawk Valley. And business tried out a new technique of destruction of labor, which worked very well. It was not through goon squads and breaking knees and all that kind of business. That wasn't working very well anymore, but through the more subtle and effective means of propaganda. The idea was to figure out ways to turn the public against the strikers, to present the strikers as disruptive, harmful to the public, against the common interests. And the common interests are those of us, you know, the businessman, the worker, the housewife, and so on. That's all us. And we want to be just together. We want to have things like harmony and Americanism and working together and so on. And then there's those bad strikers out there who are kind of disruptive and causing trouble and breaking harmony and violating Americanism. And we got to stop them so we can all live together, you know, the corporate executive and the guy who cleans the floors who all have the same interests. We can all work together and work for Americanism in harmony, liking each other. That was essentially the message. And it was a huge amount of effort was put into presenting it. Recall, after all, this is the business community, so they control the media and they have massive resources and so on. And it worked. It worked very effectively. In fact, it was later called the Mohawk Valley Formula, applied over and over again to break that strike. And these were called scientific methods of strike breaking, and they worked very effectively. Mobilized community opinion in favor of vapid, empty concepts like Americanism, who can be against that, or harmony, who can be against that, or to bring it up to date, support our troops, who can be against that, or yellow ribbons, who can be against that. Anything that's totally vacuous, you know, and that diverts, and after all, what does it mean to be in favor of, what does it mean to, so if somebody asks you, do you support the people in Iowa? I mean, can you say, yeah, I support them, or no, I don't support them? I mean, it's not even a question. It doesn't even mean anything. And that's the point. The point of public relations slogans like support our troops is that they don't mean anything. They mean as much as whether you support the people in Iowa. Of course, there was an issue. The issue was, do you support our policy? But you don't want people to think about the issue. That's the whole point of good propaganda. You want to create a slogan that nobody's going to be against, and I suppose everybody will be for, because nobody knows what it means, because it doesn't mean anything. But its crucial value is it diverts your attention from a question that does mean something. Do you support our policy? And that's the one you're not allowed to talk about. So you have people arguing about, do I support the troops? You know, of course I don't not support them, and so on. And then you've won. That's like Americanism and harmony. We're all together, you know, empty slogans, let's somehow join in them. Let's make sure that we don't have these bad people around who disrupt all of our harmony with their talk about class struggle and their rights and that sort of business. Well, that's all very effective. It runs right up to the day. And, of course, it is carefully thought out. You know, the people in the public relations industry aren't there for the fun of it. They're doing work. They're trying to instill the right values. In fact, they have a conception of what a democracy ought to be. It ought to be a system in which the specialized class are trained in order to do their work for the service of the masters, and the rest of the population ought to be deprived of any form of organization, because organization just causes trouble. They ought to be sitting alone in front of the television set and having drilled into their heads daily the message which says the only value in life is to have more commodities or to live like that rich middle-class family you're watching, and to have nice values like harmony and Americanism. And that's all there is in life. You may think in your own head that there's got to be something more in life than this, but since you're watching the tube alone, you assume I must be crazy because that's all that's going on over there. And since there is no organization permitted, that's absolutely crucial, you never have a way of finding out whether you're crazy, and you just assume it because it's the natural thing to assume. So that's the ideal. And great efforts are made into trying to achieve that ideal, and there is a certain conception of democracy behind it. The conception of democracy is the one that I mentioned. The bewildered herd are a problem. We've got to prevent their rage and trampling. We've got to distract them. They should be watching the Super Bowl or sitcoms or, you know, violent movies or something. Every once in a while you call on them to chant meaningless slogans like support our troops, you scare, you got to keep them pretty scared, because unless they're scared properly and frightened of all kind of devils that are going to destroy them from outside, you know, or inside or somewhere, they may start to think, which is very dangerous because they're not competent to think, and therefore it's important to distract them and marginalize them. Well, that's a conception of democracy. And in fact, going back to the business community, the last legal victory for labor really was 1935, the Wagner Act. After the war came the decline of unions, and in fact of a very rich working class culture that was associated with the unions that was destroyed. We did move to a business-run society at a remarkable level. This is the only capitalist, state capitalist society, industrial society, which doesn't have even the normal social contract that you find in comparable societies. So outside of South Africa, I guess, this is the only industrial society that doesn't even have national health care, where there's no general commitment, even minimal standards of survival for the parts of the population that can't follow those rules and gain things for themselves individually. Unions are virtually non-existent. Other forms of popular structure are virtually non-existent. There's no political parties, no political organizations. It's a long way towards, not totally, but a long way towards the ideal, at least structurally. The media are a corporate monopoly, basically have the same point of view. The two parties are two factions of the business party. Most of the population doesn't even bother voting because it looks meaningless. And they're just, they're marginalized and properly distracted. At least that's the goal. The leading figure in the public relations industry, Edward Bernays, actually came out of the Creel Commission. He was part of it, learned his lessons there, went on to develop what he described as engineering of consent, which he described as the essence of democracy. And, of course, the people who are able to engineer consent are the ones who have the resources and the power to do it, the business community, and that's who you work for. It is also necessary to whip up the population in support of foreign adventures. Usually the population is pacifistic, just like they were during the First World War, sees no reason to get involved in foreign adventures and killing and torture and all that sort of thing. So you have to whip them up. And to whip them up, you have to frighten them. Bernays himself had an important achievement in this respect. He was the person who ran the public relations campaign for the United Fruit Company in 1954 when the U.S. moved in to overthrow the capitalist democratic government of Guatemala and installed a murderous death squad society, which remains that way to the present day with constant infusions of U.S. aid. To prevent the democratic deviation that had taken place there. With regard to domestic programs, it's necessary to constantly ram through domestic programs to which the public is opposed, because there's no reason for the public to be in favor of domestic programs which are harmful to most of the public. And that, too, takes extensive propaganda. We've seen a lot of it in the last 10 years. The public for the Reagan programs were overwhelmingly unpopular. Even the people who voted for Reagan, by about 3-2, hoped that his policies would not be enacted. If you take particular programs like, you know, armaments or cutting back on social spending and so on, almost every one of them was overwhelmingly opposed by the public. But as long as the public is marginalized and distracted and has no way to organize or articulate its sentiments or even to know that you have these sentiments. I mean, the people who said, I'd prefer social spending to military spending, people who gave that answer on polls, as people overwhelmingly did, assumed that they were the only people with that crazy idea in their heads because they never heard it from anywhere else. You know, nobody's supposed to think that. And therefore, if you do think it and you answer it in a poll, you must assume, well, I'm sort of weird. That's what I think. And since there's no way to get together with other people who share that view or who will reinforce that view and help you articulate it yourself, you don't even, you know, you feel like an oddity. You feel like a kind of an oddball, so you just stay on the side and you don't, you know, pay any attention to what's going on. You look at something else, like the Super Bowl. To a certain extent, then, that ideal was achieved, but never really completely. There are institutions which it has as yet been impossible to destroy. The churches, for example, still exist, and virtually, you know, a large part of the dissident activity in the United States comes out of the churches for the simple reason that they're there. So, you know, you go to some European country and give a political talk, may very likely be in the union hall. Here that won't happen because unions barely exist. And if they do exist, they're not political organizations. But the churches do exist, and therefore you often give a talk in a church. Central America solidarity work mostly grew out of the churches, mainly because they exist. Well, the bewildered herd never gets properly tamed. So this is a constant battle. In the 1930s, as I say, they kind of arose again, then they're sort of put down. In the 1960s, there was another wave of dissidents. There was a name for that. It was called, by the specialized class, it was called the crisis of democracy. The crisis of democracy was regarded as entering into a crisis in the 1960s. The crisis was that large segments of the population were becoming organized and active and trying to participate in the political arena. Now, here we come back to these two conceptions of democracy. By the dictionary definition, that's an advance in democracy, but by the prevailing conception, that's a problem that has to be overcome. That's a crisis that has to be overcome. The population has to be driven back to the apathy and obedience and passivity that is their proper state, and we therefore have to do something to overcome the crisis. And great efforts were made to achieve that. It hasn't worked. I mean, the crisis of democracy is still alive and well, fortunately, but not very effective in changing policy, but certainly effective in changing opinion, contrary to what a lot of people believe. But great efforts were made after the 60s to try to reverse and overcome this malady. One aspect of the malady actually got a technical name. It was called the Vietnam Syndrome. The Vietnam Syndrome, the term that sort of began to come up around 1970, it's actually been defined occasionally. The Reaganite intellectual Norman Podhoretz defined it as the sickly inhibitions against the use of military force. And there were these sickly inhibitions against violence on the part of a large part of the public that, you know, just no, people didn't understand why they should go around torturing people and killing people and carpet bombing them and so on. And it's very dangerous for a population to be overcome by these sickly inhibitions, as Goebbels understood, because then there's a limit on foreign adventures. It's necessary, as the Washington Post put it the other day rather proudly, to instill in people respect for the martial virtues. Now, that's important. If you want to have a violent society that uses force around the world to achieve the ends of its own domestic elites, it's necessary to have a proper appreciation of the martial virtues and none of these sickly inhibitions about using violence. So that's the Vietnam Syndrome, and it's necessary to overcome that one. It's also necessary to completely falsify history. That's another way to overcome the these sickly inhibitions to make it look as if when we attack and destroy somebody, we're really protecting ourselves and defending ourselves against major aggressors and, you know, monsters and so on. There's been a huge effort since the Vietnam War to reconstruct the history of that. Too many people got to understand what was really going on, and that was bad, and that has to be, including plenty of soldiers and a lot of young people who are involved in the peace movement and many others. And it was necessary to rearrange those bad thoughts and to restore some form of sanity, namely a recognition that whatever we do is noble and right, and if we're bombing South Vietnam, that's because we're defending South Vietnam against somebody, namely the South Vietnamese, because nobody else was there. It's what the Kennedy intellectuals called defense against internal aggression in South Vietnam. That was the phrase that Adlai Stevenson used. It's necessary to make that the official picture and the well-understood picture. And that's worked pretty well, actually. When you have total control over the media and the educational system and scholarship is conformist and so on, you can get that across. One indication of it was actually revealed in a study that was done at the University of Massachusetts on attitudes towards the current Gulf crisis, study of beliefs and attitudes and television watching. One of the things that was asked, one of the questions asked in that study, people were asked, how many Vietnamese casualties would you estimate that there were during the Vietnam War? And the average response on the part of Americans today is about 100,000. Now, the official figure is about 2 million. The actual figure is probably 3 to 4 million or something like that. The people who conducted the study raised an appropriate question. They asked the question, what would we think about German political culture if, when you ask people today how many Jews died in the Holocaust, they estimated about 300,000. What would that tell us about German political culture? Well, they leave the question unanswered, but you can pursue it. What does it tell us about our culture? It tells us quite a bit. That's necessary to overcome the sickly inhibitions against the use of military force and other democratic deviations. On this particular case, it worked. And the same is true on every topic. Pick the topic you like, the Middle East, international terrorism, Central America, whatever it is, the picture of the world that's presented to the public has only the remotest relation to reality. The truth of the matter is buried under edifice after edifice of lies. It's all been a marvelous success from this point of view in deterring the threat of democracy, achieved under conditions of freedom, which is extremely interesting. It's not like a totalitarian state where it's done by force. These achievements are under conditions of freedom. If we want to understand our own society, we have to think about these facts, and they're important facts and important for those who care about what kind of society they live in. Well, despite all of this, the dissident culture survived. It's grown. It's grown quite a lot since 1960s, in fact. In the 1960s, the dissident culture, first of all, was extremely slow in developing. There was no protest against the Indochina War until years after the United States had started bombing South Vietnam. And when it did grow, it was a very narrow dissident movement, mostly students and young people. By the 70s, that had changed considerably. Major popular movements had developed, the environmental movements, the feminist movement, the anti-nuclear movement, and others. In the 1980s, there was an even greater expansion to the solidarity movements, which is something very new and important in the history of at least American and maybe world dissidents. These were movements that not only protested but actually involved themselves in the intimately often in the lives of suffering people elsewhere, learned a great deal from it, had quite a civilizing effect in the United States, right in mainstream America, and all of that has made a very large difference. Anyone who's been involved in this kind of activity for many years must be aware of this. I mean, I know myself that the kind of talks that I give today in the most reactionary parts of the country, you know, central Georgia, eastern Kentucky, or anywhere you like, these are talks of the kind that I couldn't have given at the peak of the peace movement to the most, to the most active peace movement audience. And now you can give them anywhere. People may agree or may they not agree, but at least they understand what you're talking about, and there's some sort of common ground that you can pursue. Well, that's all signs of a of a civilizing effect. Despite all the propaganda, despite all the efforts at the thought control and manufacture of consent, nevertheless, an ability and a willingness to think things through, skepticism about power, has grown. Attitudes have changed on many, many topics, and that's it's kind of slow, maybe even glacial, but perceptible and important. Whether it's fast enough to make a significant difference in what happens in the world is another question. Take the famous gender gap. In the 1960s, attitudes of men and women were approximately the same on such matters as the martial virtues and the sickly inhibitions against the use of military force. Nobody, neither men nor women, were suffering from those sickly inhibitions back in the early 60s. The responses were the same. Everybody thought that the use of violence to suppress people out there was just right. Over the years, it's changed. The sickly inhibitions have increased all across the board. But meanwhile, a gap has been growing, and by now it's a very substantial gap. According to polls, it's something like maybe 25%. Well, what has happened? What has happened is that there is some form of at least semi-organized popular movement that women are involved in, the feminist movement. And organization has its effects. You know, it means you discover you're not alone. You know, others have the same thoughts that you do, and you can reinforce your thoughts, and you can learn more about what you think. You can learn more about what you believe. Well, that kind of, this is a very informal movement. It's not like a membership organization or anything. It's just, you know, it's like a mood that spread and that involved interactions among people and so on, and it has a very noticeable effect. That's the danger of democracy. The danger of democracy is that if organizations can develop, if people are no longer just glued to the tube alone, you may have all these funny thoughts arising in their heads like sickly inhibitions against the use of military force, and that has to be overcome, but it hasn't been overcome. Well, you can illustrate this wherever you turn. Let me finally turn to the topic. Actually, let me delay one longer. Instead of talking about the last war, let me talk about the next war, because sometimes it's useful to be prepared instead of just reacting. There is a very characteristic development going on in the United States now. It's not the first country in the world that has done this. There are growing domestic social and economic problems, in fact, maybe catastrophes. Nobody has any idea what to do. Nobody in power, at least, has any intention of doing anything about them. If you look at the domestic programs of the administrations of the past 10 years, I include here the Democratic opposition, there's really no proposal, no serious proposal about what to do about the severe problems of health and education and homelessness and joblessness and crime and, you know, soaring criminal population, the jails, deterioration of the inner cities. I mean, you know, the whole raft of problems, you all know about them. They're all getting worse. Just in the 2 years George Bush has been in office, 3 million more children crossed the poverty line, the debt is zooming, the educational standards are declining, and the whole, you know, real wages are now back to the level of about the late 50s, and nobody for about most of the population, and nobody really has any thoughts in their heads about doing anything about this.
All right, this has been Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett, and we were listening to Noam Chomsky, a talk called Media Control, The Spectacular Achievements of Propaganda. Look for more information on media control on the web, and I'm sure you can find it. I want to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, and engineer, D'Angelo Jones. And this is Black Sabbath, War Pigs, and we're out.
You've been listening to Indie Media On Air on your revolutionary station, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and streaming globally at kpfk.org. The Voices from the Frontline edition of the 4 o'clock report is coming up next. Stay tuned.
fields of bodies burning.